Man rule number 17 is about when it's appropriate to cry and not cry. And I'm going to skip down past Articles 1, 2, and 3, which deal with it's okay to cry at the birth of your firstborn male child, at the death of a good hunting dog, and at your best friend's marriage to your ex. But article number 4, it's an important one, is when is it okay to cry at a movie? And for almost under any circumstance, a movie about an underdog that comes back and saves the day, wins the game, almost any of those are okay. And it doesn't matter if it's a team sport like Hoosiers. If you get a little verklempt at that, boys, it's okay. Now, no tissues, okay? You got to do the sleeve wipe. But Hoosiers, or how about this, Remember the Titans? Okay? Or if you combine one of those movies with, like, national patriotism, you know what I'm talking about? The Miracle? Yeah. 1980, the hockey team U.S. takes on the evil empire, the Russians, we win. Oh, if you don't cry at that, there's something wrong with you, son. Or if it's an individual. An individual, it's okay, the underdog. Rudy Rudiger. Right? Okay? Anybody with me? Or this one, Michael Orr, The Blind Side. Holy cow. Okay, you need to get a little bit moved by that. But there's also under rule number 17, article 4, there's a footnote. A lot of guys don't know this. It is permissible to cry even if the underdog is not human but an animal. Now, it needs to be a real story, so crying for Chewbacca or anything, but it needs to be a real story, and the animal has to be either a horse or a dog. But Secretariat, that's okay to get a little into that. Or Seabiscuit, you're just fine. Now, the reason I bring this up, ladies, is that you might be sitting next to your significant other, and in this particular message, we're talking about an underdog that wins the day. So if he gets a little emotional, it's okay. No one is actually going to be hurt in the filming of this sermon. Now, the chapter is chapter 11 of the story. It's the famous story of David and Goliath. If you were here last week, you heard Pastor Don preach a message about the first king of Israel, Saul. Saul was ordained by God through the prophet, and remember, Samuel. Samuel goes and anoints Saul, but Saul, who stood tall, fell hard. And when he did, God pulled his hand off of Saul, and he put it on David. David, it says, was a man after God's own heart. And so we have kind of a prequel on page 145 to this story of David and Goliath. While you're turning there, I want to give you the theme of the day. Here it is. It's in your program. God chooses underdogs as giant slayers. And sometimes that just touches, I think, something very deep in the core of a man. Because all of us, I think, feel kind of like we're an underdog. We're at a disadvantage. We're playing hurt. And if God can use us to do something that is bigger than ourselves, that's kind of like a dream come true. So Samuel is told by God, go to the house of Jesse. Jesse had 8 boys. And when Samuel said, well, God told me one of your boys is going to be king. Oh, that's a great day for Jesse. And he brings them out one by one. The oldest, Eliab. Oh, he's one of those guys you're jealous of just looking at him. It's like a, you know, eye candy for women. He's just tall, dark, and handsome. And Eliab, as he's standing there, God whispers something in Samuel's ear. I want you to hear this at the bottom of page 145. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. God doesn't judge the way other people judge. Good thing for David, too, because he had 4 disadvantages. We've left some space in your program to write these 4 down, should you care to. Most obvious is he's the youngest of the sons. Now, being young is not necessarily a problem, but if you're the baby of the family, you know you'd kind of wish that people stopped calling you the baby of the family. The second thing is less obvious. After Eliab was Abinadab, God rejected him as well. And then number 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all of them were rejected. And Samuel had to ask, is there another son in your family? And Jesse said, well, yeah, but he's out watching the sheep. He's not what you would call regal. His father appears to have been ashamed of David. You ever feel like that? Like, guys, your dad isn't really proud of you? I mean, getting him to say those words like pulling teeth. If I could just press pause here for just a second. I love my dad, and he was a good father, way better father to me than his father was to him. But I don't honestly have a lot of memories of my dad taking me out hunting or fishing or even throwing a baseball. And I think part of the reason was when I was going through puberty, pretty pivotal time in my life, he was going through a divorce. And so in some of those developmental times, I just didn't get that manly father-son time. And I'm not blaming him, especially when you know his father. My dad was conceived when Grandpa was 65 years old. I know. Go, Grandpa. But you can only imagine, there wasn't a lot of baseball being played in his front yard. And there wasn't a lot of hunting and fishing time there. And so I kind of inherited this family line. But I don't think I'm the only one. I talk to a lot of guys who, like, if the truth be told, you scratch just beneath the surface and they question their own manhood. It's like everybody else has this man's manual of manliness, and you don't know the page numbers. You don't know Rule 17. Nobody showed you how to shoot a gun or like wrestle an elk to the ground with your bare hands. There's something, and you just feel like there's something missing in my manhood. I was probably, I would guess 35, maybe 40, before I was comfortable in my own skin. And I'm amazed at David, who had a father who didn't even recognize him. Yet he stands up as such a man. He had one deficiency, that he was the youngest, another that his father kind of ignored him. A third was that he was a shepherd. Now that may seem like a good job to you, but in Israel, that's the lowest job you can get. He had a dead-end job. And most of us recognize men get their self-esteem by more by what they do than by the people they do it with. And finally, his brothers bullied him. You'll see that in the story coming up, but I have to wonder, how did David get to be such a great guy when he didn't have a father, poor manliness in him? And here's a, it's just true. A guy gets a sense of manliness from his father. So where'd David get it? The answer, from his father. Not from Jesse, from Jehovah. See, David is known not just for being a shepherd, but for being out with a sheep and singing these songs to God. He didn't just have a slingshot, he had a harp. And somehow he came face to face with God in the outdoors and sang praise to God. And I just want to say, what these guys do, these men and women who lead us on stage in worship, that's not a prelude to the show. That is a prerequisite for being a man after God's own heart. And gentlemen, if you don't know how to meet God face to face and connect with him, you will not ultimately be a man after God's own heart. And you might connect differently than other guys. Some love music and can sing real well. The other guys maybe journal. David did a lot of that. You know, you read the Psalms. For some of you, it's more like being outside and seeing the stars. David did that too. In whatever ways you connect with God, it is imperative that you get your manliness from God, or you won't be a man after God's own heart. So we move forward to the story, the big one, David and Goliath. Couple pages later, in page 147, at the top of the page, you read that they are in the Valley of Elah. Now, that's where the battle's going to take place between the Israelites who are on one side of the mountain and the Philistines that are on the other side of the mountain. And if you've watched Braveheart, you know kind of how the ancient battles go. We all line up and shout insults at each other. And some of the Israelites would shout to the Philistines,
Your mother smells like a goat.
In the Middle East, that's kind of bad. And another guy would shout back, yo mama, she's so ugly, makes my camel look good. So that's kind of the Middle Eastern shouting back and forth. But in the Valley of Elah, only one dude's talking smack. His name's Goliath, and he's described there in the first full paragraph, page 147. A champion named Goliath was from Gath. He came out to the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. This is a cubit, bottom of your elbow to the top of your fingers, and a span from the bottom of your hand to the top of your thumb. Six of these, one of these is over 9 feet tall. The dude was, well, ginormous. And he's wearing all kinds of armor. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he wore a coat of scale armor. It was bronze, weighing 5,000 shekels. Translation, 125 pounds. Now, when I graduated from high school, I weighed 125 pounds, dressed, wet. I could jump on Goliath's back and he'd go, oh, who put another coat on me? This is ridiculous. The guy is a monster. He also wore like greaves on his legs to cover his legs. And then it says his spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and it had an iron point that weighed 600 shekels. That's 20 pounds. I work out with dumbbells that are 20 pounds. This is what he puts on the tip of his spear. That's insane. He doesn't even actually have to hit you with it. If he just gets close, the backdraft is going to suck your brains out your eyeballs. And then look at the last sentence. I think this is unnecessary. It says, his shield bearer went ahead of him. Are you kidding? Like he needs a shield bearer. So this guy comes out, and I'm gonna paraphrase the next paragraph. It's not exactly accurate to the Hebrew, but it's close. Goliath came out on the top of the hill and shouted taunts at the Israelites, and it went something like this. Red Rover, Red Rover, send your baddest dude on over. We'll have a real fight. One-on-one, man-to-man, winner takes all. And nobody moved a muscle. He says, this day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other. Okay, press pause. Meanwhile, back at the camp, David's in Bethlehem, and his dad, Jesse, acknowledges him. Son, I need you to do something for me. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. What is it? I want you to take these cheeses and this grain and these loaves of bread to your brothers on the front line. And David's going, giddy up. I mean, he was probably about 13 when he's anointed. Now he's probably about 16. Not old enough to fight, but old enough to want to. You remember, guys, at 16, you were attracted to everything shiny? Okay, so we never grew out of that, but David is just going, oh, man, I can't even sleep. He gets the stuff early in the morning, saddles his donkey, and off he goes. Leaves the supplies at the camp, and he goes straight to the front line. First thing he saw, a head of a giant. And it just kept rising over the hill. Holy cow, look at that guy. And Goliath had been doing this for 40 days, every morning, every night. And here he comes up for the 81st time and says, Red Rover, Red Rover. And David's just going, yeah, baby, I got here at the right time. He looks up the line of the soldiers to his right. Nobody moves a muscle. Looks down the soldiers to his left. Nobody moves a muscle. And David is beside himself. He says on page 148, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Dude. Nobody's still going to move a muscle. And David's older brother, if any of you have a younger brother, you realize what pests they can be. That's the last thing that Eliab wants to hear. So he kind of pops off to David and says, why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You simply came down to watch the battle. Okay. And David acts like a little brother typically acts. Read that. Next paragraph. What? What have I done? Can't I even talk? And then he ignores his big brother and yaks on about, boy, if I was a soldier, I'd go get that guy. When I was in the wilderness, there was a bear came out, took my slingshot, boom, popped him dead. And the lion came out another time, boom, popped him dead. You just give me a chance, I'd pop that Philistine right here, right now. Well, word gets over to Saul, and somebody said, Your Majesty, we have good news and we have bad news. Good news is, we have someone willing to fight. Okay, so what's the bad news? They roll back the flap of the tent, and there is a pubescent teenager standing there. Saul tries to put his armor on David. It doesn't even fit, and David says, no worries. When I killed the lion, I just used my slingshot. When I killed the bear, I just used my slingshot. I'm going to go after that giant, and I'm going to get him. Saul's options, well, they're thin. So the next time this head comes up over the hill and says, Red Rover, Red Rover, the armies of Israel part, and out comes a warrior. You should have been there. Goliath got one good look at him and was furious. In fact, he says down here, right smack dab in the middle of page 149, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods and said, come here. I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the wild animals. Now, mark that phrase. I'll give your flesh to the birds that will hear it again. You think the Philistine was mad? You should have seen David. Now, had it been me, I would have demonstrated what a track star looks like. But not David, man. He's furious. I'm going to read this whole paragraph to you. David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will cut off your head. That's just some smack talk. Dude's got some chutzpah. This very day I will give the carcass of the Philistine army, not just Goliath, but the whole army, to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know there is a God in Israel. You better underline that sentence, because what drove David was that the world would know about the God of Israel. So if you turn your programs over, I want to give you a very brief manual on how to slay a giant. The first one, giant number one, your heart is revealed by what makes you angry. See, the real enemy is not Goliath. It's David's own heart that he has to manage. I think a lot of guys wrestle with anger management, and I would say to you men, don't try to curb your anger. It's okay to be angry, but direct your anger to things that matter. And if your anger is bubbled up by something small, then you are a small man. If your anger is bubbled up by something that is grand and large, then you're a man after God's own heart. So if your anger is shown on I-17, you're a little guy. If your anger is shown by a disobedient three-year-old, you're a little guy. If your anger is shown because you don't get your way with a remote control, that's justified. See, the problem with popping off at little things is this. We only have so much energy for anger. And when you spill it all on things that don't matter, you have none left for things that do. Tell me, gentlemen, when is the last time that you were furious because the majority of people who live in this valley are heading into a Christless eternity? Does that not bother you at all? When is the last time that you were enraged because widows and orphans that God prioritizes are neglected in our society? When is the last time that you watched the news and you shouted at the TV because all we can talk about is our own economic problems, when we do in fact have the capability and the blessing of God to eradicate poverty and hunger in our world? Does that not bother you at all? And David was a man after God's own heart because he cared about the things that God cared about. And when you begin to weep over what God weeps for, you're a man. And would you rejoice over what blesses God's heart? You're a man after his own heart. And when you are angry at what makes God angry, you're a man after God's own heart. And that's King David. And he got it someplace in the wilderness between a harp and a starry night when he came face to face with his Father in heaven and learned who he really was. That's step number one. Step number two came years later. You see, after David killed Goliath, the women of Israel began to chant, "Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands." And Saul was a jealous man, and because of that, he had it in for David. He wanted to kill him, something fierce. Twice, in fact, he tried to pin him to a wall of the palace with a spear. David's agile little guy jumped out of the way, but still, Saul's heart was pretty clear. And David ran into the wilderness, and Saul pursued him there. Saul was not bad as a warrior, fighter. David's way better. And he was always one step ahead of Saul, but one time, you'll read this on page 153, this week when you come to the story, you're not going to believe, it's actually in the Bible. David is really close to Saul. Saul doesn't know it. And David whips into a cave, and he goes to the back of the cave with his bodyguard, and they're just hunkered down in there. Meanwhile, they're waiting for Saul to ride by on horses. Saul didn't have an inkling that David was in the cave, but he had a tinkling, if you know what I mean. And Saul had to go into the cave to relieve himself. And David sees Saul coming in. I mean, this is like, whoa. He sees the silhouette of Saul coming into the front of the cave. Of course, Saul can't see a thing because you come out from the sunshine, go into a dark place. All he knows is he's got to relieve himself, goes to the back of the cave, and David sees Saul underneath the full moon. And in the middle, he pulls out his knife. This bad boy's razor sharp. And he cuts off a corner of Saul's garment. Saul never heard a thing. Finishes his business, leaves the cave, and when he's at a safe distance, David comes out and waves a white flag, not of surrender. And he said, "Saul, you missing anything?" Saul turns around, sees the corner of his robe cut off, and he realizes that could just as easily have been my throat. And he repented that day. But interestingly, so did David, because he had the audacity to cut the garment of the Lord's anointed. If you're going to be a man after God's own heart, it's not just about your anger. That reveals your heart. But your heart is revealed also by what you, get this, what you don't do in a cave. David could have killed him. And if you start putting some calendar to this, you realize David was anointed at 13, killed Goliath about 16. He didn't take the throne until about the age 30. So for over 15 years, David was chased by Saul in the wilderness. David was the one who should be sitting on the throne, but Saul was. And David decided, "I will never lift a hand against the Lord's anointed. If God has anointed me king, then I will have to wait for God's time when he puts me on the throne." And I think, frankly, most of us this week and next and next and next will have a moment in a cave where we could do a couple things with a knife. You could undercut a colleague so that you get the promotion. You could cut a corner so that you get an advantage over your competition. You could backstab an enemy so that they go down and you go up. Oh, there's a lot of ways of cutting things, breaking laws, and violating conscience that nobody would know about. But if you're going to be a man after God's own heart, you live with integrity, sometimes for decades before you ever get to the throne. Because God didn't put David on a throne because he killed a giant. He put David on the throne because of what he didn't do in a cave. And so there's a couple of life lessons, takeaways, if you will, from these two stories. a word, just a word. From David and Goliath, the word that bubbled up to me was available. And I want to ask you, are you available to God? It's been so exciting for me to hear your stories and to listen in on what God is doing in your lives. And some of you right now are at a place where you feel like, man, God, I think God's calling me to this. It might be to preach, it might be to an after-school program or to some compassion volunteer service or a mission trip, but you think, I think God's calling me to this. And so far, all you've done is gone to the battle line and you've looked this way and nobody moves. And you go, somebody ought to do this. So you look that way and nobody moves. It's somebody ought to do this. Maybe the somebody's you. Maybe you are the answer to the giant that's standing right out there. And maybe you, as a member of the CCV family, would say, I'm going to be obedient to God. And I'm going to step out, even though I don't understand what God is calling me to do. And even though I know I'm not qualified for this. I don't have a sword. I don't have a javelin. All I got's a slingshot. Baby, a slingshot and a smooth stone under the hand of God is all you'll ever need to slay a giant. The other word that bubbled up from the story of the cave was the word obedient. Now, that's a hard one because being a man after God's own heart is not just about what you do. Oh, we all want to slay a giant. It's about what you don't do. Living decades of quiet dignity, being a man of honor when nobody notices that you're not taking what God has already offered you. And sometimes we feel justified. God, you made some promises to me and you're not fulfilling the promises. Oh, you wait, he will. But not if you do in the cave what's convenient for you. And so in your dark night of the soul when no one is looking, what kind of man are you going to be? And what kind of opportunities will you forsake so that if the sunshine ever comes in, no one could say to you, that you subverted the plan of God. You know, David, if you trace his life down through the Bible, it's strange. He broke at least 7 of the 10 commandments, maybe an 8th and a 9th. I haven't even done that. Being a man after God's own heart, here's my conclusion. It's not about the heart you have. It's about the heart that you're after. Lord, I want to chase after you hard. And I know that my brothers and sisters here want that too. On each of our campuses, we're longing for the heart of God. Meet us, Lord, whether it's on a hillside with some sheep or in a cave with our enemy in front of us. Lord, would you meet us there? And as our Father, remind us that you have anointed us for better things than this. I pray in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.